Is
there Sorry. A dictionary? I wasn't thinking. Okay. Okay.
So the first definition says serving to represent, figure, portray, or symbolize. And then they have a bunch of sources for why they think that that is the first or should be the first.
Okay. So how many different definitions are there of representative? Does it go for more than a page?
The pages are kind of split into four sections. So
Right. So every one quarter page is equivalent to a full page in normal type. So it's
about 2 pages.
Yeah, 2 pages of historical definitions of the word going back centuries. All of those are valid definitions. Some of them are incredibly obscure. Which one do you choose? You're a textualist. The word is what's on the page. How do you pour meaning into that bucket? Why is that one any better than any other?
Because it's very specific and it's a little bit more politically connected.
So why is specificity and political relevance important in what the word means? The word means what the word means. I'm genuinely asking because I will tell you I've been involved in briefs where we have dueling dictionaries. And you'll see 6 or 7 or 8 dictionary definitions deployed one after the other as if volume and number constitute weight. How you choose which dictionary, which definition has more salience is actually a pretty important question to textualists. It's notes in their book note. That's a terrible sentence. The use of dictionaries increased by an order of magnitude once Justice Scalia hit the Supreme Court bench. So bless you, bless you. That's the quietest sneeze I've ever seen. Okay, so just I want to make sure where we are starting to run a little short in time. We may end up bleeding a little over to next class in WVU. But I think a couple of other final points. Besides dictionaries, besides text, anything else that Scalia views as relevant in interpreting what the word representative means when you talk about judges? Just, we'll get it later. Don't worry about it.
The normal meaning of representatives brought over legislators and narrowed in candidates. He says that the scheme of Section 5 also makes sense without the need to bring judges into the to elect provision in Section 2. And then he talks about how the principle of one person, one vote has been suggested as sort of the baseline of Section 2 in different types of case law. And they also, I think, said that it doesn't apply in the case of judges also in that specific case law.
Exactly.
And so he said, you know, Congress was making vote dilution claims available with respect to elected judges. It would be for the first time extending a remedy to a context which one person, one vote doesn't apply.
So they're not taking away. You're just not giving. Judges aren't covered. One person, one vote, never extended to judges under constitutional interpretations or the prior interpretations of the older language. So when Congress amended in 1982, there's nothing inherently contradictory, and they said, we're going to extend it to everyone but judges, we're not taking away something that the judges had, which would be seen more logically inconsistent. So, but look behind the conclusion, the tools. Notice once again what we're talking about here. The use of, should have written down here, precedent. I got so distracted talking that judicial precedent is irrelevant. Notice that Justice Scalia, the great textualist, is not afraid to use prior judicial interpretations of language as filler of the meaning of the statute terms. Second, he's also looking to logical and statutory consistency, but to different purposes. So we're seeing some similarity here. The question, of course, is the focus overwhelmingly on the use solely of text as the driver for what the lodestar meaning is. Okay, anything else you'd add at this point, or questions? I think if I'm going to add a small coda, Justice Scalia does make an important concession, I promise. Let me finish my sentence, and I'll come right to you, I promise. Remember, he says judges are still protected. You still have the Section 5 submittal process to DOJ that they have to scour the rules of that election to make sure they don't discriminate. You still have the opportunity to participate protections language. You just don't apply this elected representative disparate impact analysis to judges. The specific intent protections still apply. The constitutional baseline for judges is still there. If you can find that smoking email, Scalia says you're good. So that backdrop makes this interpretation more logical, more consistent with the purpose of the statute overall. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So just getting back to the ordinary meaning of at the time it was written, to the time the case is going on, I'll use an extreme example. Let's say there was like a 1900 statute that said you can't fire somebody for being gay. Mm-hmm. And that term has changed a lot, almost like the ordinary interpretation, even though the dictionary says
you know, the evil temptation for law professors in this situation is to say, what do you think? Let's imagine a statute in 1902 that allowed people to fire employees who were excessively cheerful, gay. The words change over time. There is linguistic drift. There's actually a fascinating essay by Sigmund Freud on how words actually tend to turn into their opposites over time. For example, for those of you who hail from the Northeast, wicked. Yeah, super wicked, yeah. Wholly different meaning now. So with that in mind, what do you do if you're a judge and you're presented with language that's fossils in amber from a different time, but is being applied to a new situation, and the words themselves haven't changed, but their meaning has shifted? And I'm going to be unfair to you and stick a pin in it and say we're going to talk about that expressly. Not only in the In re Dana case, which we've already talked about, but also in a case called Bob Jones University. But I would suggest start thinking about that, because that's a fundamental question. And it's one I frankly have wrestled with in practice as well, because it does happen.
So what would the textualism specifically? Mm-hmm.
Then the short answer to that is there is no doctrinal, there's no Bible of textualism that says the way it must be done. Different justices and judges have different approaches. Some are originalists. They essentially look to what the meaning of the word was at the time it was passed, and it's fixed. And if the Congress wants to change it, they've got to go in and change the language to harmonize it and update it. There are others who say that the ordinary meaning is subject to change, but it depends on how the word is used and what the intent was of the legislature that passed it. So to a certain extent, Congress controls how flexible the language is. If they use an incredibly open-ended word that they know is going to change, they intend for the judges in the future to fill it with different meaning as circumstances change. What is material, quote unquote, for a securities exchange disclosure? Changes over time. And the courts, by Congress's use of very broad language, are empowered to fill it. But is that, that's sort of, you're moving from this strict, hard-pressed textualist to more of a sort of middle ground of textualism. And, you know, it also raises an interesting question. You're saying the legislature, to a certain extent, can control the way courts interpret language by specifying what sort of degree of modulation is allowed. I mean, is that an Article III violation? That was a long answer. Sorry about that. But it's something I'm very interested in, because I'll just simply say the crux of environmental law, which is what I live and breathe, all the major statutes were written at least 27 years ago, and most of the important ones are written over 40 years ago. And a lot of the words in those statutes have migrated. They've changed. How do you sort of update that stuff? And we're fighting over that right now every day. Okay. Okay. We haven't even gotten to our second case yet. Before I do, any questions before we leave behind the Voting Rights Act? Are you asking me what I think, or are you asking me what a textualist might say?
What a textualist of today would probably most likely, a judge of a textualist would look at today, based on those.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm not tipping my hand as to whether or not I'm a textualist on that. So, but I just want to make sure. I think the short answer is the text is still the text. It's still bicameralism and presentment, and that is the law. If it's voted in a straight party line and there's a incredibly close division, it's still the only thing that's the law is what's on the page. So partisanship's only relevant when it alters the process that generates the words so that you end up with things that don't look like normal legislation. So we've like talked about omnibus bills, or we've talked about things being slipped into appropriations bills. That might alter the rules you use to interpret it. But bottom line, it doesn't matter how partisan it is or how screwy the politics are, the words are the law.
What happens? Do you think they have a stronger stance now because of the...
Who has a stronger stance?
The textualists think they have a stronger position because it's like, we're only focusing on the law, not what this guy was clearly saying just to appease his party. If in the committee reports, etc.
Wow. That's a very good question. I think I need to go home and sip a bottle of Blanton's and think about that one. We'll find out. But if I remember right, though, the language was if you don't win the bottle, you have to buy everyone lunch. Is that it?
No, I think if I win the bottle, I got to buy everyone.
So you should be hoping you lose, don't you?
Lunch is not defined.
I hope you guys are ready for donut holes for lunch. That's a very, very good question. And I would say there's a practical, real politic answer, which is if statutory interpretive doctrine is driven by the Supreme Court, the textualist hand has gotten much stronger just the past 2 years. Although it's interesting, both Kavanaugh and Gorsuch are not as necessarily doctrinaire as Scalia was portrayed to be. So it's an interesting question in that respect. Okay, so with that in mind, any other questions? I thought I saw another hand up, but it may have been just a figment of my imagination. All righty. Okay, second case. And we're going to try and do this one a little bit more quickly. But this one is the one I promised you yesterday, the attorney's fees case. Yeah, West Virginia University versus Casey. And for here, Courtney, you are a free woman. Thank you so much. You did an excellent job. But feel free to jump in on the second case if you so choose. Let me find another helpful and willing soul. How about Derek? Would you be able to jump in and help us on this one?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you could, describe to us what's the issue involved in this case. Okay. And what's the statutory language that's driving the answer to this question?
I think it said
and everyone knows this already, but we're probably looking at page 397.
It says, a judge or clerk of any court in the United States may tax as cost the following: fees of the clerk and marshal, fees of the court reporter for all or any part of the stenographic transcript necessarily obtained for use in the case, fees and disbursements for printing and witnesses.
Stop. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Are we done? We're textualist, fees for witnesses? Isn't this the easiest case you're going to read all year?
No, because I don't think that covers the expert witnesses.
Why not? Does it say except expert witnesses?
Well, it didn't say except, but it didn't say it.
Okay. Well, continuing on the same language, just to sort of flesh it out a little bit, take a look as well on number 6. Doesn't this also answer our question for us? Why not?
Again, it doesn't say expert witnesses, it just says experts.
So just expert doesn't include expert witness?
I mean, it didn't say it.
So I guess all right. I'm sorry. Courtney, were you raising your hand or just lifting your plug in?
No, sorry, I was lifting
my hand.
Okay. Jay? Is this board appointed experts and expert witnesses are usually not
board? Okay. They can be, but you're right. The court appoints it and you lose, the court gets to happily tax the cost of the expert on your sorry hide, right? But if you put up the expert, according to this, in theory, the court can assess the cost. The catch is, this is one where another statute screws you. Sorry, that's an indelicate term. That causes you difficulty for your clients. It turns out there's another statute that caps the amount you can charge for that expert. And the amount, if I remember correctly, is how much? $30? Is that right? $30 per day. Would it shock you to know that I've been offered to be paid over $1,000 an hour as an expert? $30 doesn't hack it. I know there are people who charge $5,000 to $10,000 an hour. They tend to have both MDs and JDs and PhDs. They're a rare breed, but that's why they charge so much. So effectively, if you cap it at $30, and your expert witness is, you're relying on the court to assess the cost of that expert witness, you ain't getting an expert. You're done. You're cooked. This statute effectively precludes your ability to litigate. Does that make sense? So, Derek, if I captured, I didn't mean to grab the mic from you there, but is there anything else you'd add to that?
No.
Okay. So, this is where the roles are reversed. As Scalia writes the majority opinion. And as always, I start with my favorite question, who wins?
I think it was determined that it's
okay.
Expert witness was not included in this statute.
Okay, which means who wins? Does West Virginia have to go home or do they get... All right, so effectively, West Virginia University doesn't get paid for its experts, which means in theory in the future, if they get shortchanged on Medicaid payments, millions of dollars, they can't sue effectively because they may not be able to pay for their experts. Okay, but the government wins. They don't have to pay. Casey was the head of HHS at the time. All right, how do we get there? I mean, this is a statute that supposedly gave people the power to sue over Medicaid reimbursement shortfalls. It would seem to be that an expert witness would be a key thing here. Why does the West Virginia lose this case?
Well, I think they lost because I think in Scalia's reasoning, she was saying how U.S. Code treated expert witnesses and attorneys and the other language in the statute as distinct items. And pretty much expert witnesses wasn't included in the statute.
So I want to make sure I've gotten what you're saying. My attention may have wandered a bit. So if you look to the whole panoply of the U.S. Code, there's multiple statutes, and Congress showed itself clearly able to say attorney's fees and expert fees when it wanted to. Lots of statutes do. They didn't do it here, so therefore the omission speaks to intent. Is that what you're saying? Or is that what Scalia is saying? Okay. I didn't mean to ascribe Scalia's mind to yours, all right? Okay, anything else?
No.
Okay, so that's a pretty simple rationale. I will suggest as well there's a bit of a hidden backdrop here, 2 points. You know the American rule, that typically the winning side does not get to collect its attorney's fees from the other side. Each side bears their own litigation costs typically. So part of the backdrop here is that it's changing the tilt of the playing field to allow the court to tag someone with cost. So that's not discussed in the case, but I just want you to be aware that's sort of the headwind West Virginia University is playing with. The other is, notice the person we're talking about here has the cushiest job on earth. He's an expert, or she's an expert, that never testifies. Consulting expert. You basically look at the reports and give your learned opinion, you charge your fee, and you're done. You never step inside the courtroom. Now, I think part of it is that's what West Virginia was trying to recover for, not their testifying experts, but their consulting experts. Did that make any difference? They were using their attempted recovery fees from their experts who were only consulting. They never set foot in a courtroom. They never testified. So to a certain extent, the argument was they were not testifying witnesses under Section 1920. Did that hold any water?
I'm not really understanding your question.
That's okay. I mean, to a certain extent, they try to thread the eye of the needle by saying, well, yeah, there's a cap on experts of $30 a day, but this guy wasn't a witness. He was just our background backbench guy. He never set foot in a courtroom, therefore this $30 cap on witnesses doesn't apply.
I think they're trying to bypass that by saying that
so was Scalia having anything to do with that?
I think it still didn't. She still didn't buy that argument. Mm-hmm. She didn't feel like it was just. And just still talking about how they were just different, like that expert. It was like a non-expert. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically expert is expert whether they testify or not. And since Congress didn't say experts are included along with attorney's fees, you can't smuggle them in under the tent of the, quote, attorney's fees, quote. Okay? I don't mean to put my thoughts into your head. Does that capture what your reading of Scalia's opinion is here?
Yes.
Okay. So basically Scalia, the ultimate textualist, looks outside the text. He looks at every other statute in the U.S. Code to figure out what the word means inside this particular statute. Notice again the assumption of consistency. The idea that Congress uses not only the same word in the same statute consistently, but they use it consistently across the entire spectrum of everything from immigration to criminal to tax to IP, all those antitrust, all those laws. I'm sorry, no, your hand went up? Right, so all the other statutes would be ridiculously written if attorney's fees automatically included expert fees. Why add it in all those other statutes? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know where that comes from. Like, people are redundant all the time.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure if you've had experience of writing contracts or legislation, you say one thing, you think, oh, wait, I better cover my bases. I'll add 6 or 7 synonyms for the same thing. Kill, maim, hurt, beat up. So it doesn't necessarily mean that perhaps that there's an intention of avoiding replication by adding another word, you're actually adding something new to it, arguably. You're just kind of making sure you're repeating the same thought to make sure it gets covered. Let's hold that thought. That's going to be really germane next week. When you're reading this case, what I suggest is not only is the idea that you can look to the entire code to identify the meaning of a particular term in a particular statute, the other thing this case is really notable for, and I'd like to flag it for you, is Stevens writes a marvelous dissent here, doesn't he? Ivy read the words thick grammarian spectacles and circled it and thought, ha, burn. So Derek, very quickly, since we're down to 2 minutes at this point, what did Justice Stevens say to refute Scalia's interpretation of the word attorney's fees to exclude experts by relying on the rest of the U.S. Code? Mm-hmm. Sure. If the purpose of the statute is to give people the right to sue to recover their rights, that seems to be a driver for the way we should interpret the term attorney's fee for this statute. Otherwise, you frustrate the whole reason Congress wrote the statute. That's sort of the purpose-driven interpretation, which Stevens is famous for. But notice, he says specifically, it is foolish to look to every other statute that Congress has written for meaning when you've got the legislative history right there in front of you to answer the question directly. It is foolish to try and find a analytically neutral meaning of a term without figuring out what this word is a tool designed to accomplish. What is the purpose of the statute? And here it was to provide a real right to sue. And if you can't get your money for experts, a lot of smaller NGOs, particularly ones dedicated to protecting the rights of the indigent or civil rights, just never get off the runway. So that was an important factor. The other thing Stevens did, which was an interesting point, which I'll point out myself, Congress consistently overruled the Supreme Court when they took this narrow literalist view. And he lists 6 different statutes. And he says, predicts that Congress will do the same thing with this interpretation. And he was right. Does that matter? Does it matter that if you interpret language in a statute from 20 years ago in a way that you are certain, even though it may be literally correct textually, it is going to bait Congress into overruling you and rewriting the statute? Do you pay attention to what the current Congress thinks, or are you solely concerned with what the original Congress thought? Which one matters? So save that thought, because I'm going to now pause. We're still in the middle of our great doctrinal debate. What I'd like to do is leave you with 3 questions that we'll start with in our next class as our review, looking back, sort of to help remind you all what was going on with Romer and with Casey. Number one is, and this is one I'm wrestling with, I'd be really genuinely curious what your thinking is on it. Does subject matter? Scalia focuses on what the words are and what the structure is and the consistency. Does it matter if it's a civil rights statute? I assume that you guys, if you haven't already, will soon be dealing with Caroline products and the idea of having different levels of scrutiny in the constitutional setting based on whether or not you're dealing with discrete and insular minorities who are vulnerable. If you're dealing with a topic that has special concerns, should you have different rules to how broadly you read that statute? In other words, do you just read all the same, or do you modulate? Number two, when you argue about the ordinary meaning of a word, aren't you just really sort of using it as kabuki play? It's just shadow play? You're just basically, it's a proxy for what your values are. I mean, in particular with Romer, when Scalia was talking about representative not being a judge, notice the substrate there is judges are different. His value proposition of judges as not democratically elected, accountable to population officials, heavily colored the way he interpreted the term representative. Stevens, on the other hand, seems just fine with elected judges and them being accountable to the public if that's what the public chooses. Does ordinary meaning insulate you from these kind of value propositions? Are we still sort of being subject to the same kind of judicial lawmaking? We're just calling it ordinary meaning. And then last, and this is one I don't know the answer to, and I'd be curious what you guys think. Why does coherence and consistency matter? Brian made an excellent opening foray into this discussion. The idea that people can only understand the law if the law has a fixed, relatively stable meaning. But that assumes that the law is a giant, seamless artifice. Edifice? That's the word I'm looking for. that is meant to be built in one big time in a logically consistent way. And we all know from our first part of the class that just ain't necessarily so. So let's start with those three. Then we'll pick up our last school of doctrinal thought, which is sort of a pragmatist, interesting, economically driven theory of statutory interpretation. This is our way of wrapping up the sort of underlying thinking of statutory interpretation before we turn to, in our next class afterward, the real specific tools of statutory interpretation, which doctrines and canons and maxims matter. And with that in mind, I'll take a breath. I monologued you at the end. I try not to do that. Any questions? Things you want to kick around? All right. Then I will start doing my remedial baseball discussion after class. And I'll see all of y'all, I guess, next week. Enjoy the weekend.